from Margaret Atwood. This poem is called Up. It's capital letters, U-P. You wake up filled with dread. There seems no reason for it. Morning light sifts through the window. There is birdsong. You can't get out of bed. It's something about the crumpled sheets hanging over the edge like jungle foliage. The terry slippers gaping their dark pink mouths for your feet. The unseen breakfast, some of it in the refrigerator you do not dare to open. You do not dare to eat. What prevents you? The future. The future tense, immense as outer space. You could get lost there. No, nothing so simple. The past, its destiny, and drowned events pressing you down like seawater, like gelatin filling your lungs instead of air. Forget that, and let's get up. Try moving your arm. Try moving your head. Pretend the house is on fire and you must run or burn. No, that one's useless. It's never worked before. Where is it coming from? This echo, this huge no that surrounds you, silent as the folds of the yellow curtains, mute as the cheerful Mexican bowl with its cargo of mummified flowers. You chose the colors of the sun, not the dried neutrals of shadow. God knows you've tried. Now here's a good one. You're lying on your deathbed. You have 1 hour to live. Who is it exactly you have needed all these years to forgive? This is one of those big poems. It encompasses so much. I am particularly captivated by that part about the future. Did you catch it? What prevents you? Atwood asks, and then answers. The future, the past, destiny like seawater, like gelatin filling your lungs instead of air. Tina's All Ages reflection helps me see how often we all use metaphor. And certainly, metaphor abounds in the realm of the poet. Destiny like seawater, says Atwood. Audre Lorde, in the quote that I've had pinned to my bulletin board ever since I began pondering this service, also employs the metaphorical language of poetry specifically to address the future. Here's what she says. Poetry is not only dream and vision. It is the skeleton architecture of our lives. It lays the foundation for a future of change, a bridge across our fears of what has never been before. I think what this bridge metaphor could mean, especially to Lorde, as a Black writer, feminist, womanist, lesbian, and civil rights activist, who was not often safe or comfortable in this culture, is that poetry can help us create our future by connecting our reality to what we expect or desire to come next. Poetry infuses art into life, or maybe it just calls us to see that life is inherently artistic and artful. And so, fueled by metaphor, poetry can expand our understanding of life. Before we go too much further, let's just get one thing out of the way. I can feel it nipping at my heels. Not everyone is a poetry person, right? I'm sure some of you might be thinking that a poem here or there is palatable, but a whole service, that's really going too far. Maybe poems aren't your cup of tea. That's fine. But I will say that poetry sometimes gets a bad rap for being too flowery and uncomplicated. Dream and vision, but totally unanchored from reality and common sense. It's not like science, which Tina describes as being able to definitively explain things about the weather. Poetry can be a little hard to pin down. Someone recently said to me that poetry makes them tense because figuring out what the poet means is so challenging. How do we know what we are supposed to take away? Probably this is related to why someone else mentioned soon after that they especially relish hearing poetry from the original author. Our glimpse of that today is from Kathy, who gave us context about the original piece that she shared. There's no denying the satisfaction of the clearly stated. She wrote a poem about her son, who hates piano, and it's called For My Son, Who Hates Piano. Czesław Milosz gives us another example of such directness when he says, the purpose of poetry is to remind us how difficult it is to remain just one person. And then he gets a little flowery. For our house is open. There are no keys in the doors, and invisible guests come in and out at will. Milosz himself was definitely more than one person, if the label applies to anyone. The Polish poet was also a prose writer, an anti-Nazi resistance fighter in Warsaw, translator, high-level diplomat, and eventually U.S. citizen. Similarly to how it is difficult to remain just one person, it's even harder for a poem to have just one meaning. Kathy's poem obviously means something specific to her, but as soon as she reads it to us, we get to filter it through our specific truths. Not only do we get to, we actually cannot avoid doing so. We are bound to hear in it truths different than hers. For no reason I can fathom, Kathy's poem brings to my mind a family friend. She was my dad's college student and used to babysit my sister and me. Now, even though she's grown up with her own family, we maintain close ties. Is the connection that she plays piano? Who knows? But when I think of her, a powerful memory arises of her oldest child tentatively sounding out a brand new word. S-O-A-P. Soap. Soap! While his parents and I cheered at this little impromptu poem he had created. I doubt that this anecdote is particularly relevant to Kathy. Why would it be? But for me, the recollection is an unexplained gift of her poetry. This is part of poetry's purpose, the very reason why we might bother with poems at all. It's the bridge, Lord would say, the bridge to each other, to our histories, and to whatever will come next. Some sense of the past is foundational to any future-gazing endeavor. The origin story for this service starts last spring at the Fellowship's annual Question Box service. For those of you who haven't attended one, our tradition is for folks to jot down questions about anything they've been wondering and on which they think their minister might have an interesting perspective. Instead of delivering a prepared sermon, the minister responds spontaneously to as many questions as time allows. Rather than the unfortunate know-it-all / stump the minister vibe that these services sometimes have at other congregations, causing many of my colleagues to really hate this format, at this fellowship, I have been struck by how deeply The questions dive into the real and hard issues of life. Usually the themes are ones I care immensely about, but have no definitive conclusions to proclaim. You know, the kind of stuff poets write about. Last spring, all three services produced one or more different questions about spiritual practice. What is a spiritual practice? How do I get one? Why would I want to? And how do I know if one would help me or if I'm doing mine right? These questions became the theme for our Wellspring Wednesday Adult Education Program, a spiritual practice survey course. I recently offered one about poetry as my spiritual practice, and I'm going to tell you a little bit more about that later. But the next two that we have coming up are about prayer as a spiritual practice with Reverend Kathleen Rolenz on March 1st, and photography as a spiritual practice with our member Mary Ellen Vixta on March 8th. Here's my take on spiritual practice and what it means. Spirituality is about living out the idea that we are connected to something bigger than ourselves. It's a universal human experience, something that touches us all. That's the spiritual part. Practice is also an interesting concept to consider here. The dictionary defines it in two ways. First, as the actual application or use of an idea, belief, or method. And secondly, as a repetitious activity or skill for the purpose of acquiring or maintaining proficiency at it. Now, not every pastime is a spiritual practice because not every activity helps cultivate spiritual development. So how can we tell if it does? My colleague, the Reverend Meredith Garman, says that some indications of developing spiritually include more connection with others and nature, more episodes of overwhelming appreciation, decisions flow more from intention or spontaneity, and less from fears based on past experience, less investment in conflict and judgment of self and others, more genuine curiosity, bigger capacity to love without expecting anything in return, a growing awareness of kindness offered, and more interest in extending the kindness to others. He says that if you find a routine that helps you to have more of these benefits, then doing it might be a spiritual practice for you. I believe that an activity is more likely to work as a spiritual practice if you engage it in each of these three ways, all three of them. One, with the intention of cultivating spiritual development, that's your goal. Two, with a collective relational element. So, like doing your practice as part of a group or with some sense of connection to your ancestors or other people. Three, with regularity, that you have a recognizable pattern. If your spiritual practice is attending worship, attend every week. If it's making art, do that art every day. When asked about spiritual practice at the question box service, I shared about my own. It's simple. Every day, I read one poem. This humble habit has taken different phases and shapes across the years that I have been doing it. Like in college, when I was coming to terms with anger as a normal emotion, and my own anger as not only normal, but maybe sometimes even helpful, I found myself drawn to the validation of the furious, bleak, screw you, cruel world type of poetry. And I still kind of have a soft spot for it, if I tell the truth. Yet lately, I am finding a lot of satisfaction in poetry that celebrates or maybe even just notices the soft, the mundane. Like Tina on a nighttime ski. Or that phrase of Kathy's about turning her kid over to the piano instructor. I don't know why that part got me, but I found it very moving to imagine her patiently waiting to shepherd him on to the next part of their day. I love those moments when the unremarkable gives way to a mystical, overarching vision of the future that Milos might characterize as hosting those invisible guests, the ones that come in and out of our open house at will. Lord's metaphor, of course, is that the daily poems I encounter are my bridge. They link my ordinary reality to the words on the page or screen, to the future of my unfolding day, and then to the expanded horizon that is one of poetry's best legacies. Poetry is a bridge that meets us wherever we are and then takes us forward. Linda Paston is a poet with unique qualifications to weigh in on the future. As a young adult, she was an acclaimed writer, even beating out Sylvia Plath for a Mademoiselle Poetry Prize. However, she decided to give up writing poetry in order to concentrate on raising her family. After 10 years at home, her husband urged her to return to poetry. Since the early 1970s, Paston has reflected on quiet, everyday themes. She is interested in the anxieties that exist under the surface of normal life. Maybe because she gave up a future in poetry for everyday life and then circled back around to a brand new future, more poetry. Besides, deep down, aren't we all a little anxious about the normal and the everyday and its unwritten future? If we are lucky, poetry or some other beautiful and mysterious force might help us not quite alleviate our anxieties, but perhaps face them chin up and heart out, knowing that we are not without a bridge to draw us into the future. Paston's reflection on this is called A New Poet. Finding a new poet is like finding a new wildflower out in the woods. You don't see its name in the flower books, and nobody you tell believes in its odd color or the way its leaves grow in splayed rows down the whole length of the page. In fact, the very page smells of spilled red wine and the mustiness of the sea on a foggy day, the odor of truth and of lying. And the words are so familiar, so strangely new, words you almost wrote yourself. If only in your dreams there had been a pencil, or a pen, or even a paintbrush. If only there had been a flower.